I'm Paula Gordon. I am with Bill Russell, and we are with David Orr. We are in the Lewis Environmental Studies building, which is your brainchild and for which you're given enormous credit. And I do want to talk about the building, but it is the larger context in which this building matters, isn't it? When I said surprise, I wouldn't have thought a revolution could happen in education.
Well, a revolution can happen. When education occurs well, it is always revolutionary. And not in the sense, I think, that we typically use the word revolution. It's a different kind of thing. Education is something that you, of course, can begin in 12 years of undergraduate, 4 years of graduate education. But when it's done right, it's only a beginning. It's a preface to a whole life. And learning is a lifelong process.
I hate to quote people to themselves, but just this one time.
Oh, go ahead and do it.
I was really stopped in my tracks by a book you wrote called Ecological Literacy. Also, Earth in Mind is a wonderful book talking about education, environment, human prospect. But ecological literacy absolutely stopped me to think about the concept of what a time of great change we live in. I say that those words a lot, but this book and the whole series that came out of State University of New York was talking about moving from the so-called modern to the postmodern. Well, I've heard those words bandied about. Never did it make the kind of sense that your articulation and your series editor, and you've been a part of the series as well, you have a line in here that I must read to you. It's very short. History is a record of many things, most of which were not planned or foreseen. Isn't that part of what you're saying about education and the role it must play in a lifetime's process? That you can't plan it, and you didn't plan it, and there are things we must plan, and?
Well, you can't plan it, but what we do, and Bill maybe can pick up on this because of background in systems thinking, what you can do is to equip people to learn in a world where you can't plan. And so you're planning for a world in which that is the primary characteristic, where it's always going to be surprising. There are always going to be changes. And the old ideas of education in the industrial era is you learn a certain set of skills, and then once you've learned it, you've got your body of knowledge, and that's all you need. But that's not the way the 21st century will unfold. We're going to see all kinds of surprises, all kinds of opportunities, all kinds of threats, all kinds of things good and bad that we can't, that's simply not on our radar screen. And education ought to equip people to understand how to learn, not with necessarily a specific body of knowledge. That's why the idea that you can have lists of things that you learn, and once you've mastered the list and you know the dates of, 55 things in the world, well, that's enough. No, it's not enough. The idea that life unfolds, and there's never been a time when learning needs to be more flexible, because now in the 21st century, much of what has happened in the last day or so, we've been talking with Janine Benyus and other people about adapting to a world in which we have to re-engage nature in a conversation. And so much of our education in the past, in the industrial era and all the way back to Reformation and so forth, the origins of the modern academy, has been a monologue. We've been talking to ourselves, and now we have to engage nature in a very different conversation, and also ourselves in a very different. This is a global world now, and it's not a world where a certain nation or a certain privileged group in a nation can engage in the conversation, and that's adequate for history. So this, students are coming into, I think, young people are coming into an enormously exciting century and an enormously dangerous time. And this is that old Chinese symbol of crisis that has danger and opportunity intertwined, and that really epitomizes the age we live in. And education, to be relevant, has to be a very different kind of thing. It's more than just lists. It's more than rote memorization. It's now the capacity to think and reflect creatively. One other point on this. We typically think of the academic word rigor, and rigor is going deeper and deeper into subject matter, and that's fine. We need that kind of thing. When you go on an airplane, you don't care whether the pilot has read Shakespeare or not. You want that pilot to be a good pilot. But the array of things we see on the agenda in the 21st century require a different kind of thinking, more like lateral rigor, and that is combining knowledge across fields. This is systems thinking. Right. And the important dimension is to understand the rules by which you combine information or knowledge in ecology, let's say, with economics. And so intellectually, we have to teach people to walk on two legs. That rigor needs to be seen in both of those dimensions.
When you say that airplane, it's all well and good that my pilot hasn't read Shakespeare until something goes wrong. And then I want him to have read Shakespeare. I want him to have thought about life forms. I want him to have a pretty flexible way of thinking, because if he doesn't know what's wrong, he needs to be able to be adaptive too, right?
That's a good point. You just don't want him quoting Shakespeare.
No, no, not over the PA as we're going into the ocean. Thank you very much.
Something about you too, Brutus? Not what you want to hear.
All right, boys.
The part about we're going to exit the stage.
Strut and Fred are on the stage.
I stand modestly corrected, but don't we need to be building flexibility? And we're not telling people that they have to no longer be good airplane pilots or be good parents or whatever.
Absolutely.
They have to be able to adapt to circumstances we cannot possibly predict.
You know, Paul, this raises a good point. I agree with that. And I think that it raises a point about liberal education that we're not making. We're now justifying more and more, and this, you see this with, I think, both candidates for the presidency right now, we're justifying education more and more because of the purported impact it has on lifetime earnings. We're preparing people for the economy. And more, I think we've become a society, small s, in an economy, large, or capital E. And we need to be people. And a society, capital S, it has an economy that serves human needs, so the economy is small E. And that's a different
What a radical concept.
Well, education ought to be a means toward big ends, not small ends. My biggest fear now in education, when I go around the country and talk to the students, is that we're turning out technicians, people who will be technically competent in a small range of things, and as with this pilot, will not have read or reflected deeply on a human condition. And I think the mind is wired. I think people want to do this. We're selling ourselves short. This kind of technical education, and nothing gets technical. You know, we're combining large thinking with technical competence, and those are things that have to happen in the context of schooling and education. But I think we sell ourselves short by not including these kind of larger dimensions. And young people want them. You find, by the way, as a kind of a footnote to this, you find a real value shift in higher education that students, even 5 years ago, and then going back through maybe 30 years, placed the idea of having values and a life philosophy well above making lots of money. And you'd find students 55, 60, 70% would say, yes, I'd like to have a meaningful life, much more than I'd like to make a lot of money. Now, in the past few years, those ratios have flip-flopped, and the age of hyper-capitalism has begun to impact the way young people think about their lives, and we're selling them short.
I remain nameless, but a major thinker, think tank, somebody that runs a think tank, told us, assured us, that we are customers of our government. And I have had academics assure me that what they look at is the customers who are their students. And they do market surveys to see what their customers want, 17, 18-year-old kids and others, which raises to me a lot of challenges. Part of, it would seem, education's responsibility is to perform a comparable function to what the arts perform, which is over-the-horizon radar. Mm-hmm. We give people the luxury, or they earn the luxury, to have the time to think, to use that discipline, and to apply it in ways that make it possible for us to have some sense of what's coming at us. The other piece of that, of course, is to share that knowledge with students and perhaps with a broader society. There's also the issue, I think, that you raise, which is, you know, I think we simply characterize as the difference between training and teaching, mm-hmm. where training constrains the world and teaching opens up the world. And what you've described is a university or college, a higher education system, in fact, an education system that has essentially adopted a training mode in response to economic mandates.
I think that's true. I don't deal much with secondary or primary education, but you find more and more dialogue about and worry about standardized tests and in New York State's the Regents exam, and every state now has this, and it's part of the dialogue that's now taking place nationally about standards. And I think there are real dangers to this. And I know we have to have standards and so forth, but more and more standardized testing and the people who write them is about being able to function in the economy, not being able to live a life of real purpose and nobility. And that's a different thing. And being able to, Paula, going back to your point, being able to think flexibly. We're training a generation of standardized test takers. And so the format of the test, the way certain questions are formed and the way the certain people think that write those tests, that becomes the thing that young people calibrate their knowledge to. And so if it doesn't somehow fit that test, it's not important to them. I think it's a terrible mistake. What we need are people who know how to live well. And you think of the characteristics we will need in this century. 6 billion people on the planet. We need people who have generous hearts, lots of vision, lots of competence, but and make good citizens. And good citizens in the largest sense of that word, citizens of a biotic community, citizens of the world, citizens of a future world that's trying to be born. People who see themselves in big context. And so if you put all of those traits down, and the question then becomes, okay, how do we raise up a generation of great people so that someday people look back at this time, our time, in the 21st century, and say, hey, that was humankind's finest hour. That's when we turned this ship around. That's when we took issues that were global and problems of all sorts, and we solved them. We met them. And education played the key role in that. It wasn't...
It seems to me, I agree, but maybe not with the articulation. We're not going to raise a generation of great people. What we need is a generation of people in which there is greatness and the ability to respond to that greatness. And it would seem we have the challenge on both of those, that we are, from what you're saying, we're not creating the opportunity, the knowledge base, the sense of community that allows a small number mm-hmm. of people to become great. But even if they become great, if the rest are not capable of appreciating what that greatness is, particularly if it is different from the standard model, which right now is an economic model, that's the place where even with greatness, you've got to have leaders and led. And in the absence of the led, there is no leader.
Well, I like that. I think you said that well. And...
It also means you don't have quite as much work to do, David. You just have the leaders to educate.
Yeah, you only got to deal with 10%.
Well, I think that
but at
your
that point, you have to worry about elitism and.
Mm-hmm. Well, your point about trying to people, we talk about leadership, and in some ways, I like your point because it raises an issue of: are we elitable people? Are we capable of recognizing and following leaders when we have them, and not like sheep, but. I think also I like the word citizenship built in here because I think that we see ourselves oftentimes, all too often, as consumers. First and foremost, it's consumer rights and so forth, and we don't define ourselves as citizens. And those cause us to do radically different things. But that's, you know, one thing in dealing with young people, say a first-year student at Oberlin College. At 18, that person has... probably very little inkling of what they can become at the stature of the person embedded in their 18 years. And they'll do things, if their lives go well, they'll do things that they would never dream they could do at 18. And I think all of us as adults, by the time you're 40 or 50, begin to sense this. So one of the roles of education, I think, and whether the word greatness fits here or not, but it's an unleashing of potential so that they believe in themselves, not with arrogance and lots of ego, but they can believe that they can live a life of real greatness on their terms. And that's a different kind of thing. That's a kind of education that is an unleashing of talents and inner personality traits and allows a person to grow. And part of our task, it seems to me, in education is to help foster that sense of growth in young people.
This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are in Oberlin, Ohio. We are with David Orr, whom we will allow to be eloquent again when we return. Please be with us.